Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part two of special episode 14, where we're bringing you the three panels that took place at the Talking About Organizations Symposium on Continuities, Disruptions, and Management in the Gig Economy that we held at the University of Sussex on 15th of December 2017. First part of this episode that we released last week featured a keynote by Professor Natalia Levina, which was an amazing thing to witness, and if you haven't listened to it, we highly encourage you to go and do so. And this week we're bringing you panel number one, which featured Arianna Tassinari, Sarah O'Connor, and again Natalia Levina. These are all three fascinating speakers, and Arianna was a guest on episode 18, where we first discussed the relationship between classical management and the gig economy. Interestingly, in that episode, we actually discussed Sarah's, another speaker on this panel, article in Financial Times about algorithmic management. So it's all coming together in this symposium and in this panel. So please enjoy.
Okay, so I'm gonna kick off. So as I said, my background is that of a labor market policy and industrial relations scholar. So I'm gonna come at the topic from a fairly different perspective from what has been covered so far, and hopefully I'll do a good job in crossing, boundaries of expertise and also vocabulary of how we talk about this issue. So the, task that we had been given for this panel was to just give a short kind of kickoff introduction from our perspective of what is the sharing / gig economy and why should we pay attention to it. So I thought it would be helpful perhaps to start with a basic like definitional points about what I understand by sharing economy and gig economy and the differences between the two, which I think are quite important actually to inform the rest of the conversation. And then I'm mainly going to talk about some of the main implications that I see from the point of view of employment relations and regulation of employment relations that the gig economy gives rise to, and then propose like some puzzles or questions that can then inform the rest of the discussion. So, I mean, as always, the problem of definition is probably the hardest task, and I'm not sure if I'm going to do it justice. So, perhaps then we can also discuss definitions. But I think, when the term gig economy and sharing economy are used, they are often conflated, and actually, there is a very large heterogeneous multitude of different companies, different type of work activities that are, and also non-work activities that are encompassed under these headings. And so I think it's important to try to draw some distinctions. So from my understanding, when we talk about the sharing economy, we primarily talk about an ensemble of sort of marketplaces that often are digital, but not only, or not necessarily, that essentially connect individuals that share or exchange their personal assets, and that results in the provision of a specific service. And this is different from, at least in my understanding, from the gig economy, which denotes, at least in the way in which it's commonly used, a specific new or maybe not so new model of organization of working activities, rather than a model of peer-to-peer exchange as such. So from how I understand the gig economy, and my definition is kind of similar to the one that, for example, is adopted by like, the RSA in their work that they are doing on it, I think the term gig economy is referring to an emerging model of organization of service provision, primarily whereby workers use online platforms or apps to source single jobs that are then carried out or completed on demand, broadly speaking. So in the gig economy, work activities which would have been in the past carried out by individuals as part of an occupation, perhaps with some dimension of temporal continuity, more or less, are instead broken down into individual gigs or tasks. And then as part of this model, individuals source the single gigs and are then paid out to carry them one by one. So on a flexible or on-demand basis. So there is no necessary continuity of work or earnings guaranteed. And so the vast majority of companies that operate in the gig economy do take advantage of IT and mobile internet technology in order to facilitate that connection of labor supply and demand online. And in many cases also use various algorithmic management methods in order to allocate the tasks. However, there are, and another, probably like maybe the only point of connection that I really see between the sharing economy or the gig economy is that some gig economy platforms, you know, do not actually invest in sort of productive assets, but use the assets of the gig workers in order to provide a service. So, for example, Uber uses the assets, i.e. the cars of the drivers, in order to provide transport services in the same way in which Deliveroo uses the bikes of their couriers in order to provide a delivery service. And so in this kind of putting to value of assets that already exist is maybe where some kind of overlap between sharing and gig economy can be seen. And I think that's also why there is, you know, in a sense, in the early days of the debate, there was some, conflation of the two around this idea of sharing assets. But actually, there is a lot of gig work in which, you know, no assets are really shared. And it's a more traditional kind of, provision of a service for, on a basis of a monetized exchange. However, the gig economy is often also equated with the so-called platform economy. And I think here is where the relationship gets a little bit more complicated, because many companies that operate in the gig economy sometimes also operate as platforms, in the sense that they are set up as, and I'm not an IT or ISM person, so, you know, please correct me if I conceptualize this wrong, but like they use a model of work organization in which basically, they are set up as digital infrastructures that enable basically what are multi-sided markets. So in the through the digital infrastructure, they can act as intermediaries between a demand for certain services or labor and the supply of labor. And this is mediated and regulated through algorithmic structures of different kind. The problem is that I think whilst a lot of gig economy companies operate through the platform model, definitely not all platforms are gig economy companies. And in some cases, the gig economy term is used to refer to companies that do not operate as platforms at all, actually. And so often gig economy is used to describe any company that operates through a sort of pseudo self-employment model. And I think that creates quite a lot of confusions. And what do we talk about when we talk about the gig economy, and to what extent is every company that uses self-employed contractors a gig economy company? And does this matter for what do we talk about? So I think in my discussion, I am mainly going to talk about gig economy as referring to those organizations that act as platforms for the organization of working activities, but this is not the usage. For example, the IWGB, which is one of the main unions that is active in the gig economy organizing of workers in the UK, sometimes talks about companies like Addison Lee as a gig economy company, although it's debatable to what extent Addison Lee fits into that model. But anyway, so even within the gig economy, as I've defined it, there is still lots of distinctions, as, you know, Natalia has touched upon earlier today, about the kind of working activities that exist and take place within it. So we can, I think for me, the most helpful distinction when trying to think about it and about the policy regulatory implications is the distinction between crowd work platforms and sort of work on demand via apps kind of companies. At least this is one of the distinctions that is offered in the literature, and that I find it quite helpful. So crowd work practice. Platforms usually, you know, refers to working activities that imply the completion of tasks online. So the work is kind of carried out, you know, remotely and digitally, or, you know, in a sense of virtual work, so to speak. This would comprise, I think, the vast majority of platforms that Natalia talked about this morning. Whilst there is a second segment of the gig economy, which is kind of location-specific work, where, in a sense, the execution of traditional working activities that take place physically and, you know, in a kind of like location bound is channeled through apps that are, however, managed by firms that usually intervene in setting minimum quality standards, sometimes in setting, you know, in selecting the workforce and managing it to various extents. So it's quite different kind of work. There is a sort of differentiation and segmentation within the gig economy in relation to the specialization of the tasks, in relation to the knowledge intensity of the work. So you go from, you know, provision of like clerical work, but also traditional service activities like delivery, transport, cleaning, and so on, to
very specialized knowledge work of, you know, kind of platform, you know, portfolio-based work almost of the kind that Natalia was talking about this morning. And this differentiation, I think, matters a lot when you talk about the potential implications, the issues of risk, protection, flexibility, and so on. So it's hard actually to talk about it as a whole because it's very heterogeneous within it. But anyway, I think there are three main issues that I see as emerging from an employment relations perspective. So kind of taking a fairly macro view on it from the increasing widespreadness of the gig economy as a model of organizing work. The first one relates to the issue of like the contractual classification of workers and how that ends up sort of undermining the traditional kind of Fordist employment, dependent employment relationship. So as we know, the vast majority of gig economy companies classify their workers as self-employed contractors rather than as employees. So the idea is that in a sense, every worker is considered as a sort of standalone micro business that offers their services through the platform to a pool of clients. And in this model of organizing the non-employment relationship or like the contractual relationship between the person who carries out the task and the platform creates gray areas of regulation. So first of all, it becomes quite hard to classify what is the status of the gig economy company, of the platform itself. If it's not an employer, then what it is? If it's just an intermediary, what sort of responsibility does it have towards its contractors, towards the clients, in terms of insurance, in terms of taking responsibility if something goes wrong? And so there is a lot of regulatory debates, for example, about what is Uber? Is it a transport company? Is it a technology company? And so on. The second issue is that the fact that, you know, the self-employment category creates ambiguities with regards to what is the relationship of subordination, control, and power that exists within these this contractual relationship. So on one hand, the self-employment model allegedly creates a lot of flexibility and supposed freedoms for the contractors in terms of working time, autonomy over how to carry out tasks. On the other hand, however, this category can obfuscate the hierarchical relationship of power and control that can often and does often exist within, between the company and the contractor. And so it creates the illusion of a contractual relationship between peers in which, you know, as a self-employed contractor, I can choose to take my business wherever and set my own rates, but actually, in reality, this is a lot more complex. And again, varies hugely depending of at what segment of the gig economy we're looking at and on the contractual power of the contractor, depending on like, the specialization of the, you know, task or skill that they're offering. The other problem that, implication of this model of classifying workers as self-employed is that it has huge implications from the point of view of regulation in terms of guaranteeing rights to the workers in terms of standard employment rights from minimum wages to, protection in case of illness, sickness, maternity pay, the standard benefits that we would associate with an employment relationship. It also has huge implications for social security systems and social contributions and pension systems and the viability of social security system if, increasing parts of work is self-employment that falls outside the boundaries of it. But also in terms of, the availability of social safety nets for, self-employed workers. And the question is that, to the extent to which the state of a self-employed is appropriate or not, or whether it is a misclassification or not, really varies depending on the segment of the gig economy that we talk about. So because it's very, I think, actually specific depending on the kind of power control hierarchical relationship that exists in different segments of the gig economy. And often this becomes the one issue that like becomes the focus of all the debates. And actually, maybe in some segments of the gig economy, it's fair enough to classify people as self-employed. The problem is even when you are legitimately self-employed, what kind of, safety nets do you have available? And in the cases in which you are actually not genuinely self-employed, what mechanisms do you have available to have that sort of employment relationship recognized? And there is a lot of, issues there in terms of things that the law doesn't quite do very, very well in terms of addressing those issues. The second problem that I, the second main issue that I see in relation to what the gig economy changes is this idea of like work on demand. The workforce becomes a contingent workforce that is only mobilized in theory when there is a demand for it. And that obviously has implications from the point of view of like earning security of workers. It also has implications for working time and blurring the boundaries between time that is spent working and time that is spent looking for work or waiting for work, and how is that remunerated? And then the third issue that I see is then of like fragmentation and standardization of tasks, which I think from an employment relations perspective, I think the most interesting thing is that it allows for, in a sense, a much more easy substitutability of workers in theory, at least at the sort of lower end of the specialization. And that has huge implications for like the bargaining power that workers have. If suddenly the workforce becomes a crowd that is potentially like, you know, grows to the limits, then what power can workers exercise? Does it even matter if I withdraw my labor if there is another 300 Deliveroo riders that are ready to do the same task? Because the task has been simplified to such an extent that, you know, anyone else could kind of carry it. So I think these are like the three main. I'm not going to talk very much about algorithmic management because Sarah will talk about it, but I think, you know, this creates puzzles in terms of like, what is the balance between, you know, flexibility and security, autonomy and rights? Can this be reconciled within the concept of the gig economy, or is there a necessary tension or a trade-off between the two? To what extent can the regulatory instruments that exist in terms of employment law, in terms of social security institutions, welfare state institutions, respond to the growth of these forms of working, and what is the appropriate kind of like level at which these forms of work can be regulated? Because, you know, some of them are location specific, therefore maybe they can be re-embedded within, you know, national institutional regulatory mechanisms, but crowd work that happens through online labor markets is very hard to define. What is the appropriate arena and the appropriate mechanisms to enforce regulation? And so I think, and also, I mean, my main concern in my own research is like, what does this mean for the collective voice of workers? How can they leverage power? How can they exercise voice? How can solidarity between workers be constructed in a context in which work is fragmented and it's very individualized and so on? And obviously, like, I think we can come back to this in the discussion, but like, none of this is inherently new. I think like the gig economy, in a sense, is like the end point of a lot of trends that have been going on in like labor markets for like a very long time. It's interesting whether, you know, I think maybe we'll come back to it later, but like, is it the ultimate post-Fordist model of production, or is it actually kind of like going back in some respects to almost a pre-Fordist, very individualized kind of work activity where risks are decollectivized, demutualized, and people are kind of exposed to the brute forces of the market without safety nets? So I think these are some of the things that hopefully we can touch upon more. Sorry for being long. I'm going to shut up now.
Brilliant. I thought that was a really great overview. Given that Ariana has done such a great job of talking about these questions that I think come up most often in the kind of public debate around how do you classify these workers? Are they really self-employed? Are they not? Obviously, there have been some big court cases going into that recently. How do you regulate it? I think there's a kind of underlying thing going on that's equally fascinating and less discussed, which is this notion of algorithmic management. Because how do these companies work? How do they function? The thing that allows them to function is algorithmic management. Because if you take a company like Deliveroo, which some of you are very expert in, you know, you have this kind of motley crew of people and their bicycles. Then you don't employ them. So how on earth do you kind of make sure that all these people scattered around a big city like London provide a kind of efficient, standardized, fluent service to customers? And you can't possibly do it through human management. It would be totally inefficient. It would destroy your profit margins. So the way you do it is by using algorithms. And so in my job, I kind of last summer, I spent a lot of time with gig economy workers in London trying to understand how does that play out from the perspective of the worker? Like, what's it like to have an algorithm as your boss? What's it like to be ruled by this phone and its notifications? And it is fascinating. If you're a delivery worker, I mean, one of the kind of key things about algorithmic management is that you break jobs down into tasks. So you don't just trust someone to do the whole job from start to finish. You don't just send someone a text message and say, hey, Sarah, go and deliver this parcel to this place. It's all broken down into much more kind of discrete little nuggets. So first of all, you get a notification that says, go to this restaurant. And all you have to do is press accept delivery. You don't know where you'll ultimately have to go next. You only can see like the next little step in the process. So you say accept delivery, you go to the restaurant, then you get given the parcel. Then you get told where to go. You get told what's the best route. And then you go and do it, and you fill in along the way that you kind of fulfill these various tasks. And as well as the job of a line manager, I guess, is to direct a worker, it's also to appraise a worker. And the algorithm will do that as well, particularly in something like Deliveroo, which doesn't really rest on customer ratings in the way that Uber does. But the algorithm every week will send a Deliveroo rider a kind of assessment of how well they've done that week. So it will tell them, and it assesses them against the algorithm's view of how well you should have done. So the algorithm has worked out, this is how quick you should have been on this particular journey, given, you know, the traffic and the weather and all the rest of it. It should have taken you about 7.5 minutes, but actually it took you 8 minutes, so you're falling down there. And so it kind of gives you these very precise metrics along the way. And so when I was kind of spending all this time with these people, it really made me think of, and forgive me because I'm not an academic, but it made me think a lot of Frederick Taylor and scientific management, which of course does share a lot of sort of similarities here. I mean, he also thought that the best way to get efficiency out of workers was to break down their jobs into discrete tasks and to work out the best possible way each of those tasks should be done, and then to tell the workers to do them. And the effect was a kind of commodification of labour. And I would argue, obviously, Taylor could never have envisaged this kind of future in which there was an internet, which allowed you to actually have a workforce that you don't even employ. He was thinking about people who were employees in kind of factories. But I would argue that actually the gig economy is the kind of the natural progression of Taylorist ideas. This is what has been made possible by this sort of technology. And the other point that I want to make is that even though this is kind of most prevalent and most obvious in the gig economy, this is creeping into other areas of work as well, which is a reason that I think more of us should be paying attention, because, you know, no one in this room might envisage their career as a kind of delivery courier. But that doesn't mean that you won't be affected by these sorts of processes at some point. So I've interviewed kind of Silicon Valley companies that are now deploying algorithmic management in shops, for example. So nothing to do with the gig economy. But they have sensors in these shops so they can tell what footfall is like and what the kind of sales of each member of staff is like. And the algorithm then crunches through all the data and works out, okay, Sarah's, you know, she's not actually that good on a Monday morning. She seems to be best on a Wednesday afternoon. When she's paired with Ariana, her sales go up. When she's paired with Natalia, her sales go down. And the algorithm then works out what is the most efficient schedule that I can put together to make sure that sales are maximized. So it might be that I only ever get scheduled with you and I never get scheduled with you. And so the line managers are totally disempowered in this scenario. And actually, I spoke to a kind of a company that was trying out this technology, and they did say that the line managers had found it really difficult to get used to, obviously, because one of the key things that you do as a kind of shop manager is to construct the schedule. I also spoke yesterday to a woman who works in a call center who, so obviously call centers have always been very kind of monitored, haven't they? It's never been a fun job, but it used to be that if you were kind of taking calls in a call center, a human would be listening in and grading you on how well they thought you dealt with this. Now, there are no humans listening to her. There's an algorithm listening to her, and it's checking to see whether she uses the right words. It listens to the tone of her voice. It decides whether she's becoming argumentative or whether she's calm. And then the algorithm ranks everyone in the call center, and that determines their bonuses. So what should we think about this? I mean, so people who advocate this stuff, are creating this stuff, are pushing, are selling algorithmic management, would say that actually it's much fairer. And to be fair, like I've heard good economy workers say the same thing, that actually, particularly if you work in a low-skilled job, having a capricious human manager can be really annoying. It can be great if they're on your side, but actually they tend to have favourites, they have biases. Maybe they don't like the colour of your skin. Maybe they don't like your accent. And so they have the power to decide how much work you get normally because they're in charge of scheduling. So the kind of the argument for this would be that actually the algorithm doesn't have any of those biases, and so it will be a pure meritocracy. The argument against is that, you know, maybe that's not necessarily true. Maybe algorithms do embed biases, but they're harder to spot. And also, you know, if you have some kind of personal issue, say you've got a childcare problem, you can go and talk to a human manager about it and they can say, okay, don't worry, we'll figure something out. It's very difficult to kind of negotiate those sorts of things with an algorithm. So arguably you could end up disadvantaging people. So I just want to leave you with a couple of questions for the discussions. First of all, is algorithmic management fairer than using human managers? If so, why? If not, why not? And secondly, I mean, if it makes you feel uneasy, this notion of an algorithm deciding whether your tone of voice is correct or not, then, and it makes me feel uneasy, but like, why? Why does that make us uneasy, and should it?
I like the distinctions that Ariana has introduced in terms of what we call a gig sharing economy. And I realize that in the world I've been, you know, sort of brewing in, these distinctions are not talked about as much. And instead, the kind of confusion, but I think the terminology confusion exists, just a different one, tends to be between terms like crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, open innovation, online labor markets, and collective intelligence. And so I just want to, I don't know how relevant it is to this audience, but I think I'm glad somebody else is covering the labor issues because they're super important. But let me talk a little bit more about the knowledge issues just to clarify some of this, because I find that while the terminology confusion is different, it is problematic. And so, and the other part of why these things are problematic is because they may become mystical, right? Like you have this myths associated with how powerful these things are. And then people get confused when these myths are disappointing them in reality. So I think the historically speaking, this open innovation terminology became very popular in business schools, you know, in let's say early 2000s, something like this, well, 2006-ish, with this guy Chesbro publishing a book on it. And sort of the idea was, we live in a world where nobody, no one organization can gather all the best talent and all the relevant talent under one roof. And so you need to work with other organizations. It really had no giginess, like no individual story in it. It had more of this, the companies working together story and this ecosystems. And nowadays, as people write a lot about innovation ecosystems and putting like different expertise together. And I guess if anything, that is very much old wine and new bottles, right? Because in a sense, people have been working with subcontractors way before 2006, and like military in particular, and sort of big innovations in aerospace industry and pharma very often came from this wide collaborations and R&D that I know Greta studied for her dissertation, material design. You had this, like, lots of players in this ecosystem. Nowadays, we call them ecosystems. And I think, I don't even know if that term would have been so cool if sort of internet didn't hit it with crowdsourcing. Because once you had crowdsourcing, which, so I do want to point out exactly what the definition of crowdsourcing is based on the guy who invented it. And the guy, it's the guy, we're very nice to have lots of women panelists today, but all the terms were invented by men, I think, here. So, the editor of the Wired magazine, if you don't know this story, he has written a book called Crowdsourcing, it's Jeff Howie. And exactly, I have a quote with what he defined it. It's the act of a company or institution taking a function once performed by employees and outsourcing it to an undefined and generally large network of people in the form of an open call. And so, you know, that's 2006, by the way, which is sort of around the time when Chesbro was writing his open innovation. So these two things kind of like grew up in parallel. And one thing that I kind of tend to overlook, even though I know it's there, used to be the word employees, right? which becomes very critical in the discussion for this panel. Because it's just like, the reality is why me and others overlook it is because often we now have firms engaging in this who didn't have employees in the first place. They're like born crowd, right, kind of places. So there's no employees, so you can't be replacing them. So employees can only be referring to institutional employees, right, people who usually would be. But the part of this definition that I do pay a lot of attention to that tends to be overlooked all the time is the notion of open call. So people who are fanatics of this sort of using the terms correctly point out that platforms like Upwork are not crowdsourcing, just to be clear. So in many, many other places we see online where you don't just say anybody can do the task that is posted, but rather somebody picks who is doing the task are not crowdsourcing by this definition. And so so as an example, Amazon Mechanical Turk is truly crowdsourcing. You generally don't pick, and it's very hard to build a platform that allows you to pick. And even if you filter on reputation somehow, which some of the add-ons to Mechanical Turk do, at the end of the day, you know, in early days of our internet, when lots of you people in this room were like in elementary school, we had this cartoon that said, from New York, that said on the internet, nobody knows if you're a dog. It's just very dated. But this is sort of the idea that like if dogs somehow gained intelligence, they could be the crowd workers in Mechanical Turk, right? Anybody could be. And because of that, going forward, we sort of have this new term, and for years, I must say, of me kind of at least talking about this distinction, there was no good term for this Upwork places or places where you pick who does the work. You don't just say anybody. And over the years, I've seen microsourcing, microcontracting. Now I think the term online labor markets is sticking. So I'd say online labor markets for something like TaskRabbit, which is another one of those, and freelance Upwork. So it's really, and I don't even know if we have a clear definition, but it's something along the lines of tapping into a large online labor pool, also sometimes called the human cloud, which is even another problematic term, using some type of contracting, right? And so it's more like eBay than it is like Mechanical Turk, in a sense that you're just contracting for work rather than contracting for like buying in and bidding stuff. And the final one that gets mixed up here is collective intelligence, which I like this term, but not because of this discussion. The collective intelligence term was kind of defined more recently by Anita Woolley and Tom Malone and a few others. And it's actually purely an academic term, right? Strictly speaking, coming from people who research teams. So I don't know if you know this background, but it's basically people looking at teams and saying, when does team produce an intelligent performance? And the kind of intelligent performance that you can measure and define as sort of better than or at least as good as intelligence of individuals in a team. And they define this collective intelligence factor, which is supposed to be a collaborative as opposed to individual factors. It allows the team to perform tasks well. And the deep down origins of this concept come from a book that was published slightly before open innovation crowdsourcing became popular. And that's The Wisdom of the Crowds book by Surowiecki, which sort of, if anything, is inspired by, you know, the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And like asking the crowd almost always works. So this notion of why crowds, you know, I was going to say are intelligent, but after the last set of votes and now economists, I don't know if I can say that, appear sometimes to vote intelligently and sometimes not. But so by the way, the wisdom of the crowds was challenged in all these political elections that we have witnessed big time. So I just think it's like another set of terms, and I don't know whether it's useful or not to keep them in this discussion, but the place where I find a bunch of this overlaps, it's sort of the world you guys talk about and the world I tend to talk about, is Upwork, because you kind of end up with this confusion as to what's going on. And just in the break, I was talking about the fact that, for example, if you've been on these platforms or know them, you know that a lot of the times it's not an individual subcontractor who is providing services there, but a little firm. So you end up with this confusion because what you're imagining is this like amorphous call to this widely said global crowd, and everybody's there and equally participating and open, et cetera, et cetera. But the practical reality is it is a micro subcontracting marketplace for a particular type of work. And we do know a lot about contracting, a lot, years of literature. And that kind of becomes more relevant than some of the stuff we're doing now that is truly about crowdsourcing and how you evaluate based on output. Because both fixed price and time and material contracts are used in something like Upwork. Both of them have known faults and known sort of advantages. And I find that like the more we think about this online labor marketplaces as contracts as opposed to gig economy, maybe, the more we can actually understand what's going on there with specifically times when people get disappointed. So the difference between, I think, the online labor marketplace and sort of the traditional marketplace for contractual work, I mean, there is an obvious one that it makes the matching easier, right? It's just true. It's like in many cases when we, for the work that we would have to do internally or by ourselves, so hiring somebody we know, we now can go and find people online. And this is almost like the work that would not be done with external help otherwise, such as translations, such as editing, such as like websites. You know, I was toying with an idea of making my website being built, my personal one, by an online worker. And eventually I asked my older daughter who kind of was the best, like no contracts. She just did it. So, child labor. but I think more broadly speaking, on this issue of contracting, and that's where I'm going to like end up with the kind of stuff I want to talk about, is because instead of seeing this as like a really nice, like wide way of engaging subcontractors, we think often of these places as either open innovation or crowdsourcing. The misses that come with this new form of organizing are pervasive. And the misses for Upwork and specifically for creative development work have to do with what I would say could be called, if not infinite, then modularity on steroids, right? You have this notion that everything could be made modular, and as such, you can tap into this anonymous equivalent, like how you said, like sort of substitutable people. That's the first myth. The second one is there is infinite scale, right? So you have this, everybody in the world is on this platform, and not only are they substitutable, they're like infinitely available to substitute each other. And that's the second one. And the third one, that the beauty of digital contract enforcement will take care of all the incentives through reputation, number one, right? So this trust being enabled by reputation kind of creates a perception that if you've been there on this platform for a while, if you passed a bunch of tests and you received a bunch of positive feedback, then there should be all no risk, right? In a sense, there is a contract that governs how you get paid and that you don't get paid if the work doesn't get done. There is, complete transparent monitoring if you want to do time and material. So I think those are the three key misses that exist. And they're misses because when you get down to doing work, they're just not true. Mm-hmm. Unlike the match, which is true. Matching is easy. Everything else is still.
And that's all for part 2 of episode 40. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this special and that you're finding these discussions as fascinating as we have. For more information about what happened, please go to the episode page. There you can also download some slides and some additional content from the symposium. Please join us next week as we conclude this special episode with another panel, this time featuring Gretia Corporal, Marike Molman, and Rebecca Prentice, here on Talking About Organizations.